Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Joy Harjo, the 23rd Poet Laureate of the United States, is coming to Brookings on December 4th for a book discussion and poetry reading at the Oscar Larson Performing Arts Center on the campus of South Dakota State University. That event is free, but tickets are required. Joy Harjo is author of 8 books of poetry and a memoir, Crazy Brave. Her many honors include a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Jackson Poetry Prize, the American Indian Distinguished Achievement in the Arts Award, and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Her latest book of poetry is called An American Sunrise, and she joins me now on the phone. Joy Harjo, welcome. Thank you for making time for us today.
Yeah, it's good to be talking to you. It's been a long time since I've been to Brookings.
Let's talk about some of your South Dakota connections. Tell me a little bit about how your life is intersected with South Dakota and with people from South Dakota, from the tribes in South Dakota.
Oh, I've been through there several times. Once I was part of a casting crew. I was working on a film for Nebraska Educational TV, and I've been to Yankton many times. Standing Rock, I went there, and I didn't make it up recently. I wasn't able to, but I was up in that community probably in the 70s or early 80s, and you know, just through the years, I've had many, many visits up that way.
You write in Crazy Brave about that time in the 70s where there was really this indigenous artistic renaissance and your connections with so many other artists. Did that period continue? Do you see that is still happening today, sort of that artistic output and celebration of the arts and activism?
I think it's, you know, certainly being at IA and being part of that or watching it happen or being inside it while it was happening, you know, caused a major shift. And I think it's probably connected to all of them and maybe activism. To be a Native, just to be a Native person is an event of activism, mm-hmm. Just our presence here, here in this country.
Tell me, your childhood is spent... You live in this sort. You inhabit this really poetic place, and you tell stories about, you know, playing with bees, for example, and not getting stung. There's many examples of how you're in this space that some people wouldn't recognize. How do you look now as an adult back at your childhood and connect that with poetry?
I think as children, well, for one, we're closer to that door of emergence where we came from, and we haven't. We're still connected we realize that we're creative souls even without, you know, we don't need anyone to tell us. Children are just naturally open and creative. And a lot of times our educational system, you know, we start to shut down. You know, we start to shut down with challenges. Just, you know, if that part of ourselves, if our spirits aren't fed, you know, that kind of creativity can be shut down, especially in a society that doesn't value what it means to be a, you know, creative person, an artist.
Yeah. How has that shown up in your life? People not valuing you as an artist, you as a poet, you as a musician. What does that look like? What has that looked like in your life?
I'd rather look at people who were wonderful and helped out. And it's sometimes it's even just the small things. I was an art student at the University of New Mexico, and I would go into this art supply store. And I remember going in and seeing Pablito Velarde, who was an amazing Pueblo painter. And she looked over at me and gave me a big smile. And it was a welcome, like, yes, you know, we're Native women. You know, and she was, you know, Native women making art. And it was just like my grandmother and my aunt, who I was so close to. And, you know, small things like that matter. And then I've had some incredible teachers through my life. And I would prefer to think of them and how that, you know, I got help. You know, we all need, it's there, and it's often in those small moments of saying, you know, affirming someone's existence or their gift, whether they're a child or, you know, someone older.
Yeah. And you're that person who does that for so many others now, as especially in this new platform as U.S. Poet Laureate. Are you recognizing those people that, you know, you can tell when you meet them just by the looks on their face that that you are opening that door for them, that you are affirming for them their own poetry, their own value, their own expression?
Well, that's the gift of this position, because, you know, positions also, it's an honor, and there's a lot of responsibility, but the gift of it is that just coming in at this time, you know, as a Native woman, as a poet, in a time like this where there's a lot of, you know, the country is split, and, you know, it's a broken heart, essentially, that stepping into the position at this time, you know, it's a doorway. And in that doorway, there's not going to be any fixing of that broken heart until all the stories, you know, of the people of this country are acknowledged. Mm. And, you know, and poetry can do that. Poetry is a way to speak beyond words. And so I think of all the Native poets, a lot of people will say they've never even known there was a Native poet. And what this position says is, yes, there are Native poets. Yes, we're human beings. It really does come down to that level. And yes, we write poems. And it's not just me. We have hundreds of Native poets, very young and older than me.
And it says something, you know, people have commented on what it says at this particular day and age in American history, that they chose you, that they chose a Native American poet, that at a time when there is brokenheartedness, that they said, this is who we need right now, this voice. Turn your ears in this direction, please. What do you sort of see your role as during your tenure? You know, what do you have in mind?
Well, I'm a poetry ambassador for everyone, or for the poetry, for the art of poetry.
Yeah.
But what's important is that the country see how we're connected, Native poets, that there are it's important that they know that we're all still here. There's over 500-something federally recognized tribal nations, and that there are many poets. There are many who practice this art, who listen. Poetry is an art that we all need it. We can all use it. So at the next fall, I have I've helped edit, along with many, many of our best Native poets, an anthology, a Norton anthology of poetry, mm-hmm. of Native poetry. It's historic, you know, from the oldest poems we could find, mostly in English, some in our native languages, to the most recent youngest poets. And so that's, you know, that's going to be part of it, you know, to show that, you know, we all, you know, we're also part of this whole story, this story of poetry, the American story of poetry, just like we're essential to the American story, you know, of history, of what this country is.
What are some of the early representations of poetry? Are they all tied to music and song and prayer? What are you finding some of those early representations are?
Well, the earliest I think the earliest one we have is from the Kumulipo, which is a Hawaiian, mm-hmm. I think it's like the Hawaiian creation story, some beautiful poetry from that. And most, I think it's not just indigenous poetry, but I think most poetry of the world is not written down.
Right.
When I went to look for poetry after I'd studied poetry and read poetry in books mainly, is that most of our poetry is, you know, we sing it and we speak it. There's some incredible, very Muscogee-type speech-making that goes on in the circle that is sheer poetry, and it's a whole different art. It's an art form. And so we have examples of some of those earliest poems, and then the earliest poem in English we have is by a young Native man who passed really young. His name was Eliezer. Hmm. and we don't know his tribal affiliation. And he was published by Cotton Mather, of all people. And I think the youngest poet is a young Diné or Navajo poet, Jake Skeets, who has a new book out just out.
Right. Fascinating. You mentioned music, and music is such a part of your life. Will you tell us a little bit about, as a child, finding music for the first time? Because it's such a, it's such an important formative story that I think a lot of people who follow your work know. But people who maybe don't know you, what's one of your earliest memories of experiencing and discovering jazz and music?
Yes, that moment. Yeah, it was back when there were, this will tell how old I am, when there were no seatbelts.
Right.
So my favorite place in the car, my dad always had a really nice car. He used his Indian oil royalty money to upgrade his cars. So I think it was a black Cadillac. And I remember standing behind him and smelling Old Spice, and I love the radio. And I was probably, I would guess I was about 3 years old, maybe three, four years old. And the radio was on, and I heard this sound. I realized it was Miles Davis' trumpet. And I went into this space, you could call it an intuitive kind of space, but I went into this space where I experienced everything in that moment. It's like where I kind of walked through time, and I could see my parents from a distance as if I were much older. And it was just a moment of having compassion for that moment, and hearing and my ears opening or being opened by the sound of that Miles's horn.
And you write about this sort of this bending of time and this, the way time is folded, also in American Sunrise and some of the poetry there. Riding in your car on the road to Atlanta, now you're an adult, you're driving, and you have this other sort of time-bending moment where things that happened in the past are happening right now. Do you think poetry keeps you connected to those kinds of experiences?
I think so, because to become an artist, anyone who's practicing their art, you go into that, you're quiet. What happens in the quiet? Well, you're no longer, just hearing the sound of your voice yammering, but the quiet opens many, many doors into imagination, into the ancestral zone, into the place where you can hear the plants and the stones, and that's, artists create out of that kind of space. We all need it. And it's less and less these days when everyone is, has constant access to, 24 access to, anything you can find on the internet. It's cut out a lot of that creative, that listening time, so that we learn not to listen, not just to each other, but not even to ourselves.
Is everyone in that sense a poet, or is there room for people who don't see them? How do you sort of, the age-old question of, can anyone write poetry? Can anyone connect with poetry? Who's poetry for? How do you sort of view, that kind of big picture question about poetry?
You don't have to be a poet to write poetry. It's a useful tool. It's a useful tool for getting to know, what's going on, how it is moving, there's something very satisfying to be able to either move your body to music, or move your mind, or move your words to a kind of word music, or to an image, paint something with images with a poem, or move towards a kind of knowing that wasn't there when you started writing with your pen or pencil or on the computer. And, we go to poetry, we come to poetry for understanding, for places of transformation, like birth, death, falling in love. There's more songs devoted to that, or falling out of love, I think, than any other kind of poem, marriage, you know, any of those points where we witness something that terrifies us or gives us awe, great awe, or even small momentarily awe, you know, awe, like it's a useful and incredible tool.
An American Sunrise is described sometimes partially as a dialogue with history, as you revisit some of these places where people were forced to leave everything behind, and yet you also evoke a strong sense of present, of being, people who are currently being forced to leave a place they love behind. How do you see that connection? Talk a little bit about that, if you will, the Trail of Tears and the current, you know, migration and challenges people are facing today.
Yeah, I start the book with a quote by one of the survivors of the Trail of Tears, who says, when we basically, you know, when we made it to India Territory, or what's now Oklahoma, they killed all of our babies. And it's a terrifying thought to lose all of our children for anyone. And I think about the border. I think about how a lot of what's going on politically in this country was the same thing going on during the time of Andrew Jackson. Mm. And it's a very similar kind of time, you know, and Andrew Jackson illegally forced our removal of many, many tribal groups in the Southeast and around the country, too, not just in the Southeast, out of their homelands. And it's similar. There's a similar thing going on at the border, because for the most part, those are indigenous peoples. And there are old migration routes, but, you know, universal law, you know, states, and it's built into every cell of our hearts, is that you do not bring harm. You do not harm children. You do not bring intentional harm to children and families. And that's what's being done in our name here in this country. And that's what was done in the name of the country, you know, during removal, where our children were either, killed on the Trail of Tears or taken away to be raised without their families, without their languages, without their home, without, you know, to break the heart, to break up a people.
As part
to
of that
story of people.
As part of that conversation, do you feel sometimes poetry is the best way to address that, part of a larger tapestry, inadequate to address something? Like, what do you have a sense of how poetry intersects with meaning during such challenging historical times?
There's many ways. Not one art or not one form cannot address everything. We need, all the different arts, all the different ways of expressing ourselves, you know, towards a compassionate world. And poetry is part of that. Poetry is one of the tools. There are many tools.
You mentioned one of the things that really struck me about Crazy Brave, the memoir, was this, what you call the knowing that has served you throughout your life. I guess I would have called it intuition if I was talking about myself. But you have this sort of deeper sense of the knowing and sort of being in tune. To tell us a little bit about what you mean when you say that, and how you can tap into that knowing to help find direction in your own life.
Yeah, I tried to find a way to talk about that in Crazy Brave, because it's something that is inborn with everyone.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, we're living in you look around in the space, there's what's in the, it's like there's all kinds of space, there's all kinds of frequencies. And I guess for me, the knowing, it came, you know, at a very young age. Even as a little child, I liked the company in that kind of space. I liked being in that kind of space. And I liked a lot of time, I still do, I like a lot of time alone. To be in that. And I think every human being needs, you know, that ultimately it's about knowing yourself, which is about, you know, knowing the world. If you don't understand yourself, you're not going to be able to connect to anyone else either.
That says a lot, right? Joy Harjo, we are looking so forward to welcome you back to South Dakota and to Brookings for the upcoming event. We really appreciate your time for South Dakota Public Radio listeners today as well.
Okay, well, thanks so much, and I look forward to visiting there pretty soon.